Hello, today is June 4th, 2026, and you're with Helen at the Talk and Information Center with readings from Wired. The first article comes from the May-June 2026 issue, Cable News by Jane Ruffino. Say goodbye to the undersea cable that made the global internet possible. Sharks are innocent, or at least they're not eating the internet. As a family of cartilaginous fish, sharks are collectively not guilty of most, if not all, charges of biting, chomping, chewing, or otherwise attacking the underwater network of fiber optic cables. The people who build and maintain the nearly 600 subsea cables that carry almost all of our intercontinental traffic, supporting just about every swipe, tap, zoom, and doom scroll anywhere on the planet, have a love-hate relationship with this myth, which has persisted for decades. They might even hate that I'm starting this piece with it. If a cable is suspended over the seabed, a shark might gum it as it explores. Sometimes they'll lunge for a cable that's being pulled out of the water. But for a shark to actually bite a cable, you'd have to wrap it in fish, much as you'd hide a pill in a hunk of cheese for the dog. Rats can be a threat on land because their incisors never stop growing, so they like to file them down on semi-soft cables. But nobody ever asks about rats, maybe because, as a friend of mine pointed out, sharks make you cool, but rats sound like you have a problem. Sometimes people ask about satellites or, especially in Sweden, where I live, about alleged sabotage in the Baltic Sea. But historically, shark bites have commanded the most attention. The myth began nearly 40 years ago with the development of a subsea fiber optic cable known as TAT-A. TAT-A practically invented the concept of an internet cable. And now that it's ready for retirement, I spent time with the offshore workers, crew members, and engineers who are in the process of pulling it off the seabed. That's the real story of subsea cables, not sabotage or sharks, but the humans who take care of the physical stuff that keeps all of our digital communication flowing. Fiber optic transmission is a near magical way of carrying information by pulses of light. Most people don't even think about how quickly we've accepted instantaneous communication as normal. Even those of us who can remember when an international phone call had to be booked in advance. The more people I meet in this industry, in this network of people and things, the more insulting it sounds to hear that we only notice it when it breaks. Who is this we, I always want to know? Billions of people are able to walk around not noticing this infrastructure because of the daily work of a few thousand people, sometimes at sea, other times buried under piles of permits, surveys, and purchase orders for thousands of kilometers of cables that would join the millions of kilometers of cables on the seabed that ensure that our planet is continuously being hugged by light. I also need to clear up something else. Most people call them internet cables, but technically, fiber optic transmission was developed for telephone calls. One of the people involved was an English scientist named Alec Reeves, who also spent his time working on psychokinesis and telepathy. With fiber, voices become light, pulsate across spiderweb-thin strings of glass, and become voices again in your handset on the other end. Maybe there isn't that much of a conceptual leap between that and moving things with your mind. TAT is short for Transatlantic Telephone, and TAT-A, built by AT&T British Telecom and France Telecom, was the eighth transoceanic system across the Atlantic. It was the first to use optical fibers to transmit traffic between Europe and the United States. Fiber optics for communication had only been worked out in theory in the 1960s, and terrestrial cables were first used in the 1970s. But using this technology to span continents was practically tantamount to human galactic expansion. When TAT-A went into service on December 14, 1988, the science fiction writer Isaac Asimov spoke on video link from New York to audiences in Paris and London. "Welcome everyone to this historic transatlantic crossing," he said. "This maiden voyage across the sea on a beam of light." AT&T made a TV ad in which an earnest voiceover promised a worldwide intelligent network where people could send information in any format to anyone they want. Cue the montage of telephone operators. "This is the AT&T operator. You have a call booked for Poland? I have your call to Russia. What city in Cuba are you calling?" If they were looking to inspire viewers, it wasn't with the promise of the internet, which was still too niche for most of us to comprehend, but with the end of the Cold War. TAT-A would witness the fall of the Berlin Wall, the birth of the World Wide Web, the end of the Soviet Union, the dot-com boom, the end of Tory rule in the UK, and the beginning of the Bush years in the US, the September 11 attacks, the dot-com crash, and the dawn of social media. It was Friendster. Rather than being the last cable ever needed, as had originally been believed, it was full to capacity within 18 months, by which point there were other cables, like PTAT-1 across the Atlantic and TPC-3 in the Pacific. By 2001, the TAT series was up to number 14. After developing a fault that was too expensive to be worth fixing, TAT-8 was taken out of service in 2002. It's been sitting on the seaboard until now. TAT-A is currently being pulled up and sent for recycling by Subsea Environmental Services, one of only three companies in the world that's made cable recovery and recycling its entire business. Cable companies sometimes recover their own cables after they take them out of service, and some retired cables get new life in scientific research or military use. Most of the 2 million kilometers of it all are still right where their former owners left them. The seabed is a lot busier than you might think, so these operations are clearing space for new cables along routes that are proven and efficient, rather than disturbing new sections of the seafloor. And there's good money in old cables if you know what you're doing. It's after midnight on a cool August night, and my friend Fiona Marone here to take photos and videos, and I are watching Subsea's brand new diesel-electric cable recovery vessel, the MV Masliat, dock in the Portuguese port of Lexos, just outside of Porto. The 14 people on board are 2 weeks overdue because hurricane season arrived early, and they had to dodge storms Dexter and Aaron, which meant they collected more stress and less cable than expected. During the next week or so, they'll offload 1,012 kilometers of TAT-8, resupply the ship, then set out again to pick up another load. They drop the gangway, and there are hugs between the crew and Peter Appleby, operations manager from Subsea. Up on the bridge, we meet Captain Alex Ivanov, who has been at sea for 30 years and still takes pictures of sunsets. He scrolls through his phone to show Peter a blazing red and orange sky, then photos of some of the Dorado he caught, because when cable ship people aren't fishing for cable, some of them go fishing for fish. Peter asks how Alex likes the ship. Alex helped design it, and this is only its fourth trip out since it left dry dock in January of 2025. The captain says he loves the diesel electric. The Masliat runs on three industrial Volvo truck engines, even though he says it isn't as stable as the Rebecca, the company's other vessel. The bridge is high-tech and modern, but everything is touchscreens and sensors, and he says if he loses power, he loses everything. Then he zips off, getting ready for tomorrow. when he'll hand charge of the ship over to another captain, Vlad. Vlad will show up wearing a new T-shirt that says, "Everything can go wrong at sea" on the front, and "Not on my effing watch" on the back. Everyone who has been at sea will tell you that the most important people are the captain and the cook. And all good captains are servant leaders and will concede that the cook is more valuable. Crew members are from Ukraine, Russia, Poland, Nigeria, and Kenya. And the cook knows everyone's comfort foods. Misha, the cook who's now rotating out, heard one of the crew talking about how much he loved khinkali, Georgian soup dumplings, and the next Sunday they were on the tables. Peter always brings cottage cheese, cream cheese, and cabbage when he meets a ship in port. I'm suddenly aware that I'm not just a guest on a ship. I'm a middle-aged mom who has shown up at someone's home without snacks or a host gift. Fiona and I are also the first strangers any of these people have seen in 2.5 months. I'm here in Lexos because I'm a researcher in the material culture of the subsea cable industry, and I consider it my business to help people understand that the networks we rely on are made of physical things created and maintained by people so that we can stop saying infrastructure is invisible as if people are invisible too. Another way to irritate a cable nerd is to suggest that low Earth orbit satellites, which are unreliable in bad weather, are harder to repair and need to be replaced every 5 years, will one day by our main source of connectivity, be our main source of connectivity. Satellites are still an important component for resilient physical infrastructure, especially in areas with few or no fiber connections, but they haven't been able to compete on capacity since the 1990s. Back in the 1970s, though, satellite technology seemed so promising that the Federal Communications Commission made it clear to AT&T, if you don't do something revolutionary with cables, we're not going to grant permission for any more intercontinental submarine connections. At the time, cables relied on copper, and there's only so much capacity you can cram into a bundle of wires. So, in 1978, Bell Labs, along with its British counterpart, STC, committed to installing a nearly 6,000-kilometer-long submarine fiber connection between the U.S., U.K., and France. In Holmdel, New Jersey, Bell Labs began testing out cables, and in 1985, the company deployed its first live test system known as Opticon 1 between two of the Canary Islands. Opticon 1 worked, but it had a series of what are called shunt faults, where damage to the insulation interrupts the electrical signals. Now, here come the sharks. Elaine Stafford was the project manager for Opticon 1. In 1986, she was a rare young woman on the scene, on her way to Paris to present an update on the cable at the first of what would become the industry's main research and development conference. I'm supposed to be giving this huge talk that there's this wonderful technology and it's working fine, and it's going into service, but we had this big question mark, she recalls. They didn't know what had caused the faults. Jack Cypress, who in Stafford's recollection was two levels above her at Bell Labs, got on the bus to the conference center. And he says, "I have the shark teeth," Stafford tells me. He pulls them out and says, "These were pulled out of the faulted cable." So we went to the conference and announced to the world that it was the shark teeth. AT&T even included 4 pages about shark bite mitigation in its 36-page press kit for TAP 8. To be clear, there still isn't consensus that the sharks caused the shunt fault. Cypress wasn't lying about the teeth, but it's hard to know what really happened. Stuart Ash, who was part of the UK team at STC, insists that most shark claims really are false. If the Opticam 1 was installed with too little slack, though, and hung above the seafloor in some areas, a shark might have munched down. While we at STC didn't believe it, he says, we were swept up in the frustration or fear that sharks could interrupt these very important brand-new cables. To be absolutely sure, AT&T funded research at two aquariums in Mystic, Connecticut and Sarasota, Florida, where researchers let some dogfish and lemon sharks get a little hungry and then tested to see if they bit any of several different cables that were emitting electrical fields in different patterns. They didn't, except in seemingly random cases. To be certain about this myself, I took my shark-obsessed five-year-old to a local aquarium, where we spent 15 minutes trying to figure out how a friendly 3-foot dogfish, whose mouth looks like the coin slot of an old payphone, could do more than give a cable a soft boop. Experts who also went out into the ocean and pulled different species of sharks onto the deck to force feed them sections of cable. Sometimes they bit, wouldn't you? But there was absolutely no pattern. Still in the 1980s, despite there being no firm evidence that sharks were attracted to anything specific about the cables, the teams decided it wouldn't hurt to build TAT-8 with a layer of steel between the polyethylene insulation and the fibers. They sent shark teeth to the NYU School of Dentistry to have molds made and mounted until shark jaw simulators, which then chomped on sections of cable. The result was that lightweight deep sea fiber was produced from the start with what they called fish bite protection, which helps against abrasions and other types of everyday damage that can happen in the sea. Turns out we owe sharks a thank you and probably an apology for the force feeding. It's morning in Lexos. On the deck of the Masvaliet, I hover over a pile of TAT-8's repeaters. A long-haul submarine telecommunications cable needs repeaters to boost the optical signal to cross the distance, and TAT-8 had more than 100 of them, each encased in a watertight, pressure-tested housing that could survive up to 8,000 meters down. A rubberized cone stretches from each side of the repeater, sheathing the cable, making the whole piece about 2 meters long. In a pile, they look like a dead kraken, ready for one last writhe on the dewy deck. Repeaters weigh about 400 kilograms. It takes 3 people to pull one out of the water, cut it free from the cable, and slide it down a special ramp onto the deck. The rubber casings are stamped with the dates when each one rolled off the line, July 27, 1987, December 23, 1987, February 19, 1988, and so on. And there are identification numbers and instructions painted on them. Human hands painted the casings before they went into the water 38 years ago, and it's humans who pulled them out also with their hands. Everything about the cable recovery operation needs to be learned on the job from somebody who carries the knowledge in their body. A lot of the new crew relies on Stephen, who has chosen to stay at the position of coiler, the rank of ordinary seaman, rather than rising up the ranks as many of the others have. He's been with Subsea for 15 years since the company started, and he trains everyone. He loves the teamwork and wouldn't dream of going into a cargo ship, too much waiting around. At sea, it's part of a coiler's job to stand in the cable tanks in the ship's hold and grab the cable as it comes through the hatch from the deck above. You grasp it, and as the ship tosses, you walk backward in slow circles to coil the cable in a neat stack, because fiber cable has to be coiled by hand. You need to keep it tight, and you don't want to break the cable. It's hard to get used to, Stephen says, because you get dizzy. Another coiler describes the shifts as 14 cigarettes long. 8 hours divided into half-hour blocks so you don't get too woozy. 30 minutes on, 30 minutes off. Up the ladder for 2 cigarettes. Peter, the operations manager, hands 2 pairs of utility gloves to Fiona and me. Do you want to go into the hold? Fiona says yes instantly. I take longer. It's 10 meters down a vertical ladder, but I didn't travel here to just stand at the top of a ladder and shout, "What's it like down there?" The ship's hold has 5 cable tanks, each about half full. Most people are surprised when they see how small a submarine telecommunications cable is. But even those are usually the black and yellow steel armored portions used in shallow water. This cable, from the deep sea sections, is the diameter of a taper candle, and it looks like giant cooked spaghetti. I try to imagine being in here when it's 30 degrees Celsius, the ship tossing up and down and trying to walk in slow backward circles. Now I want to know how the cable gets from the seabed into the hold in the first place. Stephen, again, is the person to ask. He turns down the music, a mix of Ukrainian techno, American classic rock, and a medium dose of death metal, to tell me about what everyone here seems to agree is the most exciting part of cable recovery, catching the cable. First, you sail to the spot where you're pretty sure your cable is. They have a route positioning list, a spreadsheet that shows the precise coordinates of every joint, splice, and repair, along with who did it. They know where the cable has been plow buried, where and exactly when a repeater was laid, and the type of cable at every section, double armored, single armored, lightweight armored, the contemporary name for the fish bite proofed cables. To take the cable off the seabed, all you get is a hook, a rope, those coordinates, and your senses. It's roughly the same method they used in the 19th century when they needed to recover failed telegraph cables from the deep sea. A flat grapnel hook, known as a flatfish, is dropped off the bow. It falls past blobfish, anglerfish, the giant versions of crab and octopus, and below the deepest dwelling sharks, down where fish have antifreeze for blood and names like fangtooth and faceless fish. When it touches the bottom, Stephen says, we stop. They have to keep the hook flat on the bottom so they can start what they call the cutting run, sailing slowly toward the cable at a speed of about 1 knot, dragging the flatfish. The speed matters, he says. When we get to the position, we slow down to keep it from flying or dancing. Everything Stephen tells me sounds like trying to fly a kite in space, except this is all done on the deck of a ship, with ocean swells sometimes over 3 meters. If the swells hit 4, it's too harsh to work. Once the hook is in place, you have one job. Keep your eye on the line, watch for a bite. Someone spots tension in the rope, or the winch makes a move. Whoever sees it calls out. Sometimes it's been 3 hours, sometimes 24, of rope dropping and winch watching. They cut, pull, start the bow, roller, and winch, and wait to find out if the flatfish has the right catch. I repeat a question Fiona has been asking everyone. Do you cheer when you catch it? Of course they do. Captain Alex has been working with Subsea since its early days. In the beginning, I didn't have any idea how to capture the cable on the ocean floor and bring it on board, he says. Cables weren't laid to be picked up again. Sometimes it's difficult to find. The cable can shift from its initial position or be blocked by gravel or sand. They're still figuring it all out. As Subsea co-founder John Theodoropoulos puts it, I liken a lot of what we do to cleaning up space junk or all the oxygen bottles that are left at base camp at Everest. Now that I've seen all the planning and experience that goes into an operation to find and recover a cable, it's even harder to take seriously the idea that enemy saboteurs are regularly pulling this off. A more legitimate concern is disturbing the seabed, but researchers at the UK's National Oceanography Centre have started looking into the environmental impact of decommissioning, and it's not as much as you think. The biggest impact seems to come from grapnel runs and from the vessels themselves. Very few cables in service today cross sensitive ocean habitats. Where that's the case, they leave those segments in place. They also only recover a cable that's sitting on the surface of the seabed, and they know exactly where it all is because of that spreadsheet. Cables don't even tend to attract sea life colonization very often. The reef effect makes a cool story, but it seems that, just like sharks, most sea life is just not that into cables. Departing crew members are starting to say their goodbyes. Captain Vlad is passing out nuts and chocolate. Alex will do the formal handover later today. Chief Engineer Sergey is just about done with the maintenance work needed to hand over to the next chief engineer, also named Sergey. He barrels through the bridge, beelining to the good coffee machine. "This coffee machine is my wife," he shouts. He's from Crimea, and he's been a seaman on and off since he was 16. It's his hobby, the best job in the world. In a few days, the cable tanks will be empty. Next, a cargo ship will arrive. The bales will be loaded, break bulk, as it's called, directly into the hold, the way it was done before containerization, and brought to South Africa to Mertech Marine, which also specializes in cable recovery, which Theodorakopoulos tells me is a collegial competitor. Mertech is the only cable salvage company with a recycling facility of its own. It will break the cables down, steel, copper, two kinds of polyethylene. Fiber was the successor to copper, but that's just the transmission part. Fiber optic cables still have plenty of copper in them, and it's of especially high quality. The International Energy Agency says we'll be running short of copper within a decade if the manufacturing world can't find more of it, so thousands of kilometers of it is nothing to sniff at. The fiber itself is just about the only part of the cable that doesn't make sense to recycle, but there's lots of steel, and that will become things like game and vineyard fencing. Polyethylene is one of the easiest plastics to recycle, and that will be sent to a facility in the Netherlands, where it will be turned into pellets that can be used for non-food-grade plastics. By the time you read this, you could be squeezing your shampoo from the remnants of the first fiber optic cable that crossed the Atlantic, most of which spent 38 years deeper in the sea than the Greenland shark, which is known for being centuries old and extremely sleepy. And what about the rest of what went into the TAP fiber systems? Bell Labs was eventually sold to the French company Alcatel, which closed the Holmdel facility in 2006. It spent close to a decade as the largest empty office building in America and is now a mixed-use complex called Bell Works. Although it's probably most recognizable as the headquarters of Lumen Enterprises in the Apple TV show Severance. The current owners found 18 kilometers of subsea fiber from an early sea trial for TAT-A in the basement, and they commissioned an architecture firm to come up with ideas for what to do with it, among them a giant slinky. No one has used the old ocean simulation lab for a production set, but you can also rent that on a production location website. You'll find it labeled a mad scientist lair. Some of the TAT-A people are still around because there are two things that keep people in the subsea business. They like people, and they love messy problems. Even way back then, says Stafford, the Optican One project manager, it was connecting the world, doing things right, doing things well. The contrast between this world and what's happening at the application layer isn't lost on me, and the shark research makes a lot more sense. They had a big bet, a blank check, and an almost heroic sense of pride in their work that drove them to go down even vanishingly small rabbit holes. I suppose there's a third reason a lot of people are still around. Most people in this tiny industry are Generation X or older, and sometimes they cart around so much institutional knowledge that they can't retire. Stafford is near retirement age, and the guy who introduced me to her, Jean DeVos, got his start making telegraph cables in the north of France in 1961 and still works as an advisor. He's 87. The first thing Stafford said to me on Zoom was, "How is he? Does he look well?" The subsea world has been trying to recruit and train younger talent for at least the past decade, so the industry vets can get their rest. Now it's my turn to leave, so I'm climbing around the ship, saying my goodbyes, having a few last chats in the smoking area outside the crew quarters, where everyone is when they aren't working. I was promised a small piece of Tat 8, and now I have it. Before I get to the airport, I wrap my cable bundle in a shirt dress and pack it in my carry-on, a little panicked as I realize it looks a lot like a bundle of dynamite. The subsea guys also gave me a branded baseball cap, which has a stylized cross-section of submarine cable on it. I put it on in the airport in case it can answer questions about what's in my bag. Except, how many people know what subsea cables look like? And you can't wear a hat through security, so it goes into the bucket. Nobody asks any questions. Jane Ruffino is a writer and UX architect based in Stockholm. She is pursuing a PhD on the contemporary archaeology of the undersea fiber optic cable network. I spent a week recording myself doing chores for money. Who's the robot now? Reese Rogers, Source Wired. Cooking, doing laundry, tidying up. All your household tasks can be turned into data to train future humanoids if you're prepared for the consequences. I am no longer a mere human being. I am a conduit of reality, a medium of messages. I hold a knife in my hand and slice into an organic cucumber, hunching so the iPhone strapped to my forehead can capture all 10 fingers. I throw the slices into a salad bowl and end the recording. Somewhere, a baby robot is a tiny bit smarter. This was my existence for a full week last month as I performed data collection from the comfort of my apartment, teaching humanoids how to scrub dishes, fold laundry, and pour drinks, among other menial tasks. If robots are ever going to live with us and help out around the house, they need to develop fine motor skills. I performed my household chores with pride. I'm not usually contributing to mass data sets when I put away my jock straps, and I was glad to make some money too. First-person videos shot with a camera attached to a person's head or chest are a growing need as more companies attempt to build bots and improve their AI models. Even though the internet is full of scrappable videos, hyper-specific clips, like thousands of close-ups showing hands pouring water into a glass without spilling, can be critical for fine-tuning machines to excel at real-world tasks. This style of recording, called egocentric data by the industry, is in such high demand that some investors estimate leading companies will purchase hundreds of millions of hours from third-party suppliers over the next few years. I want every person on the planet to be recording themselves doing the dishes, says Avi Patel, the 22-year-old founder of data collection marketplace Kled. That's going to make a robot so that you never have to do the dishes ever again. Egocentric data collection is already growing in countries like India, where generally self-employed workers make around $125 a month on average, and these first-person video gigs can offer similar rates. As internet interest swells, more data collection companies are looking to expand in the States, like DoorDash's standalone task app launched earlier this year. Before long, many gig workers in the U.S. may start delivering reality to make ends meet, as well as the typical room temperature takeout. Thankfully, I already had a smartphone head mount in my possession from testing DoorDash's task app. My impression even then was that bespoke video data was the dystopian future of gig work, but I wanted to better understand this growing industry. Since Task is not available in California where I live, I signed up for three other platforms, Clad, Luol, and Waffle Video. The money I made was meager. I essentially trained the robots for close to free and didn't make a dent into the $2,500 a month San Francisco rent that I split with my partner. But the gigs did have one unexpected perk. My apartment has never been this clean. Clad's breakout moment came when Patel posted a video on X earlier this year, showcasing a sliver of the company's wide-ranging archive of the video data. The clip was quickly viewed more than 4 million times, and data purchasers started blowing up Patel's phone. Every major foundational model and lab reached out to me asking for data, he tells me. Robot training data is only a slice of what CLED collects from its over 300,000 users. Mostly, the startup pays people to upload their entire camera roll as AI training data. Patel has seen early adopters latch onto the gig work in Malaysia, and there's a special task section to help promote video submissions. Users pick from a list which chore they want to film and then capture content directly through the app. An hourly rate is not listed for these. Each is labeled low, medium, or high paying without a specific range. The company says that in about a month, an update will include rates for many, but not all tasks. I selected Take Out the Trash as my inaugural bot training task on CLED. It's marked as medium pay. Getting started was easy since the app guides users on what to record. Description: capture how you take out your household trash to help train real-world robotics workflows. Task requirements: record a continuous in-app video showing removing the bag, tying it, placing a new liner, and throwing the trash out. Keep the camera steady and avoid filming faces. I slipped a smartphone strap onto my head and filmed as I tied up the kitchen garbage bag and escorted it to the alleyway bin behind my apartment. I was a little anxious about the potential of bumping into one of our neighbors and having to explain what I was doing. The recording automatically shut off around the 2-minute mark before I was able to rewind the can, as the app said I'd reached the limit. Patel says the most important focus for CLED over the past year has been fraud detection. People often attempt to upload videos downloaded from the internet, as well as blank black boxes. There's also the issue of privacy. You have to make sure all data is anonymized and remove personally identifiable information, because labs won't buy from you if you don't, he says. Same thing for any bad uploads. You just have to filter that all out. CLED recently pulled out of Nigeria, Patel says, because around 95% of user-submitted uploads were either useless duplicates or fraudulent. I completed 9 tasks on CLED, recording off and on during my weekend chores, before realizing that the app requires users to upload 100 pieces of media before they are eligible for any kind of payout. A bit miffed, I decided to upload over 90 photos from my vacation last year to meet the payout threshold. Since CLED takes several days to process the data, I moved on to other platforms collecting robot training data while waiting to get my money. Luol, a platform that pays users from around the world for data, is quite similar to CLED, Both have young founders. Lowell's William Nemgal was just 18 years old when his company joined Y Combinator earlier this year. Both companies collect a variety of data beyond just self-shot videos. People are willing to record simple clips of them saying lines in their own language. Nemgal says of Lowell's interest in language preservation, why not expand to egocentric videos and documents? The app now also pays users to record their computer screens and upload photos of receipts. During my tests, Lowell felt a little clunkier than Cled in its design. The platform doesn't divvy up jobs by chore type. It simply has a record any hands-on activity from a first-person perspective listing that offers $6.60 for an hour of video. For comparison, the federal minimum wage in the U.S. is $7.25 an hour. Lowell's requirements are hyper-specific, head-mounted only, wide-angle camera turned horizontally, minimum 1080p resolution, visible hands 95% of the time. I restrapped my phone to my head and got to work in the kitchen, scrubbing plates and loading the dishwasher. I submitted a 5-minute video to Lowell's website. A day later, it was rejected. Your hands were not visible in enough frames, read Lowell's explanation. I got paid nothing at first. Lowell sent me an email a few days afterward reversing its initial decision. The message explained that while my hand visibility came in at 83% across the sampled frames, I had satisfied the rest of the listing's requirements, and Lowell would, in fact, pay out. I was 55 cents richer. Waffle Video was easily my favorite of the three platforms. Unlike Cled and Lowell, it focuses solely on video training data, and the missions I saw in the app, like shoelace tying and water pouring, pay $25 per hour of video. Now we're talking. Each data set that users create is custom built for the companies purchasing the data, so Waffle's missions are available only for a limited amount of time. The app also offers gig workers recurring revenue, essentially a syndication, if their videos are relicensed to additional companies. I think there's an amazing opportunity to create a symbiotic relationship between the people that are giving their life, their perspective, their creativity, their data, essentially, to these models, says Joshua Mesnick, Waffle's 34-year-old co-founder and COO. For that to be a reciprocal relationship instead of just a one-way street, Mesnick co-founded the startup with CEO Joey Newfield, who's 33, in 2024. Waffle is also the most detailed in its guidelines about what the app does and doesn't want. Before uploading, users are able to see every reason their submissions might be rejected, from blurry recording quality to the inclusion of copyrighted audio. Alongside an example video, the tasks include thorough instructions on how to record each chore, like these deets from pouring liquids. Pouring action must be visible. Liquid must be clearly shown. Both containers should be visible. Receiving container must be clear glass or clear plastic to be able to see changing liquid level. After startups collect these first-person videos from humans like me, the next hurdle is transforming the reams of data into sellable formats. Waffle processes every user video through what's called MAPLE, Media Asset Processing and Labeling Engine. Everything is checked for copyright. Everything is labeled, annotated, and structured to be ingestion ready for AI training, Mesnick says. Companies aren't as interested in raw, unlabeled information. They want cleanly packaged videos with highly descriptive metadata attached to each file. I really got into my video data groove while using Waffle. The rate was high enough to actually feel enticing, and I gleefully converted around the house like a reality TV show producer, hoping to film as much content as humanly possible. Tying my shoes over and over again? Done. Scrubbing the dishes until they're sparkling? Done. Pouring Diet Coke back and forth between glasses until it's flat? Done. My smartphone was essentially glued to my forehead all evening as I completed AI tasks on Waffle. Each submission was around 20 seconds long, as dictated by the app for this mission. I blazed through 125 approved uploads in a few days of work, earning $20 for my efforts. Namjiao Luel's founder worries about the future of work, despite running a company that trains robots who could one day replace human workers. My biggest fear is that unemployment will go up extremely high, more than it already is, he says. Namgyal sees Luel and gig work more broadly as a quick way for people to make some cash, not as a panacea for labor trends. Part of our goal is to also create jobs, but that's obviously a hard thing to do. Patel proudly shares that one of the top earners on CLED is a truck driver earning $8,000 a month by filming with his dash cam and submitting pictures of potholes. But this user's experience is clearly an outlier. The majority of those submitting data for AI model training are not making this kind of cash, even though the hunger for video training data seems almost boundless. Egocentric video gig work is still, well, gig work, which comes with fewer worker protections and less overall stability. Specialization might be the only way to make a meaningful amount of money doing this in the U.S. Anyone can record videos of cucumber chopping, but only an experienced sushi chef can really show the best way to slice salmon sashimi. I'm sure there's a world where chefs are completely replaced from the planet, Patel says. But they're never really replaced because they're at home filming videos, making unique recipes used to train these robots. They're getting paid. It was finally time for me to get paid, too. When CLED finished processing my 9 ecocentric videos and 97 vacation photos, I wasn't expecting much, but I was still taken aback by the payment. $1. After getting over my initial pangs of disappointment, I felt a twinge of pride. Perhaps I was helping build a better future, one where my grandkids would be blissfully unaware of the cleaning habits I had to cultivate. My pride quickly dissolved, though, the more I considered how I was potentially training the very humanoid robots that could replace humans as jobs beyond the tedious household chores. My total earning for the week came to $21.55. For me, this experience was a casual side hustle, a way to pay for a few extra Diet Cokes by completing chores around the apartment. But for workers around the world, and increasingly in the U.S., this kind of AI gig work may be accepted under economic pressure and relied on as a means to live. Teach the robot how to cook tonight so you can put food on the table tomorrow. U.S. law enforcement warns of anti-tech extremism as AI hatred grows. Daniel Bogislaw, source Wired. In the wake of attacks on CEOs, a nationwide protest movement targeting data centers, and increasing concerns about AI job replacement, federal intelligence agencies and domestic law enforcement are circulating reports with a new domestic target in mind, anti-technology extremists. More than 1,000 pages of unpublished reports from the Department of Homeland Security, FBI, and fusion centers obtained by Wire showed a national shift taking place to surveil this new and worryingly broad category of people and activities deemed an emerging threat. This new effort follows President Donald Trump's National Security Presidential Memo 7, which instructs the Department of Justice to target anyone holding anti-American, anti-Christian, and anti-capitalism beliefs, Early this month, Trump's counterterrorism czar, Sebastian Gorka, released a public counterterrorism strategy claiming that left-wing extremists are one of the three top counterterrorism priorities facing the United States. Taken together, these Trump administration directives have commanded the domestic surveillance apparatus to surveil and criminalize speech and assembly that challenges the ideology of the White House. A new focus on anti-technology extremism adds an unreported category to already public designations under a presidency that has heavily invested political and material capital in AI and data center proliferation. Among the documents in the tranche obtained by Wired is a New York Intelligence and Counterterrorism Bureau report that warns of widespread upheaval in response to AI adoption. Of particular note is a novel term for what the Bureau reports to be an emergent extremism threat. The chaotic atmosphere that may result from emergent AI technology is the next 5 years may fuel large-scale protests that devolve into civil unrest and anti-tech violent extremist activity, especially in large urban areas such as New York City, the report reads. The term anti-tech violent extremism does not appear in any publicly available DHS or FBI domestic extremism reports or guides, and represents a novel grouping of a wide range of ideologies under a single extremist category. In the same Intelligence Bureau assessment, analysts also describe a novel threat emerging in the wake of the arrest and trial of Ziz Leota, an extreme rationalist who allegedly led a small cult-like group, three members of which have been charged with murder, tied to an obsessive ideology focused on the existential risks posed by AI. While the Zizian ideology is extremist in nature, a less extreme version of the same fear surrounding the cataclysmic potential of AI are a common concern among AI alignment experts, machine learning engineers, and even frontier AI companies. Nonetheless, the Intelligence Bureau warns that paranoid views regarding AI may proliferate in the aftermath of the Zizian's trial, thanks to their attempt to reason the belief that a godlike incarnation of AI is imminent, and belief that humans must best use their time in the present to devote themselves to ensuring its compliance with human morality or face existential consequences for failing to do so. The NYPD Intel assessment follows the department's collaboration with the FBI last year to monitor the signal chat of an activist group coordinating volunteers to monitor public hearings at immigration courts in New York. According to documents obtained by The Guardian, the FBI surveilled activists as part of a broader investigation into anarchist violent extremist actors, one of the threat categories named in the new counterterrorism strategy. Created in the wake of 9/11, 80 fusion centers now pockmark the country and serve as go-betweens for federal intelligence agencies and state and local law enforcement. In addition to concerns about portions of the American populace disturbed by the rapid proliferation of AI, these centers are also gathering and circulating intelligence about alleged threats to data centers. A Western Pennsylvania fusion center, for example, claimed that adversarial actors, including state-sponsored entities, criminal groups, and extremists, such as homegrown violent extremists or environmental extremists, may target U.S. data centers, and that these actors could also exploit the strategic importance of data centers to the U.S. economy, using them for activities like cryptocurrency mining or leveraging third-party entities such as front companies to gain access to U.S. data and infrastructure. A report from the Northern Virginia Regional Intelligence Center warned that ACAVES, anti-government, anti-authority, violent extremists, influenced by government-related grievances and conspiracy theories, have engaged in pre-operational planning, targeting data centers and critical infrastructure facilities to disrupt government operations. but in the breakdown of suspicious activity reporting indicators, the intelligence report lists activities that could easily be carried out by peaceful protesters, legal experts say. These intelligence reports are part of a long tradition of agency identifying protests or even simply having strong opinions as precursors to violence. Spencer Reynolds, senior counsel at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, tells Wired. Suspicious activity reports are incredibly unreliable, often about vague or innocent behavior issued under permissive standards. These reports, often received in large volumes, allow officers to inject their own biases and see what they want to see in the facts. Among the vaguely defined activities flagged by the Northern Virginia Intelligence Center as suspicious are expressed implied threat, observation, surveillance, photography, testing, probing of security, and attempted intrusion. The FBI investigates individuals who commit or intend to commit violence and criminal activity that constitutes a federal crime or poses a threat to national security, the FBI wrote in a statement to Wired. We have no additional comment. The Department of Homeland Security did not respond to Wired's requests for comment. Meanwhile, the same intelligence center also circulated a report in March showing monitoring of constitutionally protected events and demonstrations related to critical views on technology. These events included multiple Tesla takedown protests against Elon Musk's ransacking of the U.S. government and a breakup with Tech Rager sponsored by Eject Elbit, an activist group organizing to halt investment in the Israel weapons manufacturer Elbit. In addition to intelligence analysts working inside fusion centers and federal law enforcement agencies, open source intelligence companies that contract with federal law enforcement agencies appear to be scouring the web for what they claim to be anti-technology sentiment as well. In January 2025, Site Intelligence circulated bulletins to fusion centers alleging that conversations in a neo-Luddite Discord server had turned violent, with one user of the group called for violence against tech CEOs and power plants. At this point in time, we're out and we'll continue next time.